In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
A new candidate for U.S. House, a new national security podcast, and a new t-shirt shows up in church. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, September 17th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Dakota Political Junkies offer this week's political analysis. We'll discuss a Christian t-shirt journalist Kevin Wooster saw in Catholic Mass recently. What does it mean for the separation of church and state as an idea and as a practice? We'll also look at the nuances, or lack of nuance, in political campaigns here at home. Later in the hour, NPR's Mary Louise Kelly is with us for a preview of her new national security podcast, Sources and Methods. But first, Democrat Julian Baudouin offers his thoughts on how listening to voters can help move his campaign for U.S. Senate forward. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment, and news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Sioux Falls business owner and community leader Julian Baudouin is running for U.S. Senate. The Democrat is challenging current U.S. Senator Mike Rounds for his seat in Congress. Baudouin joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to discuss why he is running. Julian Baudouin, yes. Welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Good to be back.
You have been on this show throughout the years in a variety of capacities as a community leader, as a business owner, as someone who works with African American History Museum and leads that organization. And now you are running for the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about why you decided now was the time to make that leap.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's really no better time than now, in my opinion. There's, you know, with the things that I've done in the community, as well as some of the recognition that I've been able to get nationally, I was recognized as one of the 100 most influential young leaders across the country by former President Obama. Went through his leadership program. And so after going through that Presidential Leadership Academy, it really opened my eyes to really what's next in politics. I've always kind of dabbled in politics, you know, whether it was lobbying or going up and maybe doing some interviews with some legislators just to ensure that, you know, folks are best representing people here in South Dakota. I've always had my finger on the pulse, so to speak. And so after this program, it really opened my eyes to running for office again. I know I ran for city council back in 2019, leading into 2020. And that was, you know, the year of COVID. Everything was different. And so my wife and I talked through it and figured out which position best fit right now, best fit my skill set, best fit, of course, the things that I've done in the community. And this was it.
Tell me a little bit about your background, because I was looking at your campaign website. From your parents, you learned compassion and discipline, which sounds like a very South Dakotan combination. Although, you're not originally from South Dakota. You weren't born here.
Correct.
Tell me a little bit about your upbringing, your family, and what brought you to South Dakota originally.
So my mother is a retired nurse. She actually was a psychiatric nurse with the VA. And so that discipline really comes from her being around service members, you know, her entire career. And then me growing up just being around service members as well. You know, I'd also give a little bit of that discipline to my father. He was a retired teacher. And so he was stern. He stayed on my butt, you know, making sure that I studied, making sure that my memory was good, and that I was always doing the right thing, even when no one was looking. So, you know, the compassion part, though, just comes because my mom was a caregiver. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was a caregiver. And when I tell you, when I went into law enforcement, all of these people in my family who were caring for people or educating people, they looked at me and they say, well, what are you doing? You're not a teacher. You're not going into medicine. But, you know, that really gave me a combination of the two things that I was raised to be. And when you talk about what brought me up here to South Dakota, my mom retired at the time. And so I was playing basketball in college, ended up tearing my knee. And I don't know if you remember way back in the day, I'm kind of aging myself. I'm not too old, but way back in the day when we had the in-network, out-of-network coverage in our healthcare system, I was on my mom's insurance. And so I had to come and have some in-network surgery done. And that's how I ended up in South Dakota and just ended up staying.
Yeah. Tell me about your law enforcement career.
So I spent 13 and a half years as a state trooper. And during that time, the first 3 years was out in Pierre. You know, I talk about it like it was a sentence myself, but I did time in Pierre for 3 years. And then I came back to Sioux Falls. And spent the rest of my career here. During that time, though, again, like because of the community work, but also because of the work that I had done in the community or in uniform, by being cross deputized as a federal agent, and then also doing some work on reservation land, doing some work with the FBI with the CEI initiative with the U.S. Attorney's Office, sure. I was recognized by the state to be one of the individuals who was up for U.S. Marshal. Which eventually I became the state pick for U.S. Marshal as well. And so after that, of course, that was during the Biden administration. Biden no longer is president. And so here I am left to fend for myself, so to speak. And I dove right back into the nonprofit world.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the things, the lessons that you learned from law enforcement, about public safety, about what's happening at the southern border, about our response to it. What are some of those lessons that you take on your way to Washington, should South Dakotans decide to send you there, that you can specifically tie back to your time in law enforcement?
Yeah, well, I think the responsibility is always back on the people who are serving. It's a choice. It certainly is a choice. And I would always tell folks in uniform, the individuals, because part of the time I helped out with training, and so I would always tell the younger people coming in as troopers that you can't best serve a community until you best understand the community. And so for me, stepping into, you know, the roles of nonprofit work and community advocacy and sometimes even activism really helped me understand the people that we were serving. And so that way, when you put the uniform on, you can be the best representative possible. And that's what I hope to bring to D.C. You know, just my finger is on the pulse. I'm still doing the nonprofit work. I'm still serving on several boards. I intend to continue to have communication with those boards and the people in South Dakota to make sure we're serving them the right way.
Yeah. As you travel around and listen to what people want out of their U.S. senators, what are some of the things that are coming up for you?
Well, I'll tell you the three main topics is the things that we're hearing, I think, all over the country, to be honest with you. Yeah. Medicaid is one of the biggest things we hear over and over again. But, you know, probably neck and neck with that is the dismantling of the Department of Education. There are some big concerns around what that looks like for South Dakota. The promise right now, of course, is that, you know, the funding resources will come from somewhere else. However, the reality is our state can't even afford to feed the kids now. And so where is that resource going to come from once the department is gone? We're talking about after school programming. We're talking about kids in special education. These are our most needed resources for the kids that are in education. And so for me, it's about reinvesting in education. It's not about dismantling. What we see around the country is in places like Maryland and Illinois, there's been a reinvestment, an intentional reinvestment in education. And so that's increased high school graduation rates, but it's also decreased crime rates. Those things go hand in hand, and I plan to do the same thing here.
Do you think U.S. Senator Mike Rounds is vulnerable to a Democratic challenger right now? Where do you see that vulnerability?
I think Mike Rounds is vulnerable, period, whether it's a Democrat, independent, or Republican. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he's done here recently is he's just tied himself to the presidential administration. And it's important to remember that you don't serve a president, you serve the people. And when he started losing sense in that, that really kind of not only opened my eyes, but I think it opened the eyes of a lot of Republicans as well to say, maybe we need to choose a different representative.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about how you intend, because one of the biggest problems or challenges for Democrats running in South Dakota is to not be tied to the national party leadership.
Yeah.
They're going to tie you to Biden. They're going to tie you to Obama. Yeah. They're going to tie you to Clinton, to anything that, you know, people don't like about the national party. They're going to tie it to your campaign.
For sure.
What's your relationship with that?
Well, first off, we're South Dakotans, and so we represent South Dakotans the best way we possibly can. And I will say, yes, I have had conversations with folks like Obama, and I've had conversations with folks in the national DNC, you know, on that level, because it's going to take the resources from the national level to be able to win a race like this. Again, that's the reality of it. But also, when I'm having those conversations with them, I make sure that they understand that this is not Washington, D.C., right? This is not New York City. This is not California. We are a different brand of people here. And if you are going to help with those resources, you need to recognize that, you know, we are an environment of agriculture. We're an environment of tourism. And so the things here that matter to us as South Dakotans certainly look different. And so we have to make sure that we are invested in the things that matter to us most.
Yeah. Democrats like George McGovern were able to find an unpopular ag policy from the current presidential administration of their time and then listen to what farmers wanted and bring a new farm policy to Washington. Yeah. It seems to me with the tariffs right now that even amongst the farmers who are the most supportive of President Donald Trump, they're being hurt by trade agreements and tariffs, and they're willing to speak openly about that.
Yeah.
What is your message for farmers and the ag industry to say, like, there could be a different vision, and this is what it is?
Well, I think one thing we have to do is, again, we do have to go back into history to see what farmers have been fighting for a long time and have not received yet from our previous our current representatives. One of the biggest things that I'm hearing over and over is actually a country of origin label. That really would help out our farmers and our ranchers a ton. We talk about the price of corn and grain right now being the lowest that a lot of these farmers can remember in their generation. And one of the things that could help fix that is just really understanding where your food comes from. That also helps the situation on taxes, because, of course, if you know where it comes from, you know where to buy it from. But those tariff situations, who pays the taxes on that? That's really us. That's not the country that we're placing the tariffs on. And so understanding how those two things can tie together certainly can be beneficial to farmers. And we've had several conversations with folks with the South Dakota Farmers Union about just that, how we can push that type of narrative to make sure that we are reinventing what the Farm Bill looks like. Because, you know, we've been trying to get a Farm Bill passed for I don't know how long. Well, you know, farming changes, especially because of things like AI, for example. Mm-hmm. Farming changes on a year-to-year basis. And so we have to make sure that we're reinventing who we are as producers, but we also have to make sure we're reinventing who we are as policymakers to make sure that the Farm Bill passes the right way.
You mentioned advocacy and even activism, and I think back to 2020, and you were one of those people who was a law enforcement officer, but who was also showing up after the killing of George Floyd to speak openly with people mm-hmm. and on behalf of people to say something needs to change in law enforcement. That was an interesting place for you to be in
yeah.
at the time. I am quite sure your opponent will bring that time up as an example of, you know, activism and anti-law enforcement mm-hmm. rhetoric. How do you intend to respond to what 2020 was like in South Dakota, the work, the pushback that we've yeah. seen since then, and the work that you see needs to be done ahead?
Well, so as a matter of fact, I hope he does bring it up because, yes, it was an interesting time in my life, but it also allowed me to step into a place to where, you know, leaders are folks who are not always agreed with. Real leaders are not folks who are always agreed with, but they always step into roles of accountability. And when you understand that things are not being done the right way, whether you're in uniform or in the community, you want to make sure that, again, you are serving people the way they need to be served. And so that was an unjust murder by someone wearing the uniform. And I was one of very few law enforcement officers to be able to publicly stand up and say something. However, there was a lot of conversations behind the scenes. We would not have had a crime bill introduced had it not been for law enforcement officers speaking behind the scenes. And so this was something that was necessary during that time. But, you know, I don't always just speak out against law enforcement officers. I also speak out against community members who are not holding up their end of the bargain. Accountability looks different in many different ways. And I, you know, one of the things that I always say is that it takes courage to be a real leader. And one of the things that we're seeing out of Mike Rounds right now is certainly not courage. It's more of a coward act, in my opinion, because he doesn't have the courage to hold anyone accountable in D.C. But even more important than that, he doesn't have the courage to be held accountable by the people of South Dakota. We've done about 7 or 8 different town halls to where I'm putting myself in front of the voters, putting myself in front of the citizens. And every single time, I don't make any promises to them because promises can come out empty. But I do ask for an expectation, and the expectation I have of those folks is to hold me accountable, and I will continue to consistently stand in front of those folks when I'm not serving people the right way.
That was Julian Baudouin. He is running for one of South Dakota's two U.S. Senate seats. He's currently the only candidate who has formally announced his candidacy. We'll keep you updated as the race continues to shape up. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's check in on South Dakota's elections. We'll share the latest updates and news about who might appear on your ballot next year. Seth Tupper is the editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight, and Kevin Wooster is a longtime journalist in the state. They joined me from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. We'll begin with a shirt that made Kevin Wooster do a double take at Mass. You learned something going to church. As you're walking out of Mass, you saw a woman in a T-shirt, and this gave you pause and some thoughts, and you're certainly not asking her to not wear her T-shirt, but it made you think about things. Tell me a little bit about This City Belongs to Jesus.
Well, I was minding my own business. Wait, no, I wasn't. As my wife points out, do you mind more people's business, including during Mass, than anybody I know? But I think God wants me to do that.
Always the reporter. God's reporter.
God's reporter. And it took me a minute, and I didn't know the woman. Sometimes for noon Mass, there's a regular group, and then people come in and out. And, yeah. And she was walking away, and I just noticed she had a Message T-shirt, and it said, "This city belongs to Jesus." And my question immediately was, "It does?" And I guess I'm inclined to believe that for myself, but that gave me something to think about on the drive home. Well, how would other people look at that T-shirt, and how would they see it, and what would that mean to them?
Yeah, because it had Rapid City, South Dakota written on it, printed on it as well.
Yeah, down below it said in big letters, "The city belongs to Jesus," and down below it, Rapid City, South Dakota. And I was aware that there was this movement, especially here in Rapid City, I think, but I assume it's elsewhere. This city belongs to Jesus, and that there had actually been some rallies under that theme. And so I went home and Googled it, and immediately, as you get to in the Google, "This city belongs," it writes the rest of the sentence for you to Jesus, and then sent me to the page for Rapid City. And I read some things on that page, including a reference to the Church of Rapid City, which I thought, wait, what? And that just got me thinking about this whole idea of intersection of faith and community and government and First Amendment and things like that.
What's the purpose of the organization that you've been able to ascertain?
Well, I think the very strong beliefs, very strong Christian beliefs, and I think to try and bring those to the community, and I'm sure in most senses in a positive way and not any sort of insidious way. But I think the concern that I have is as deep as I think, I hope, I try to have my Christian faith, I'm always aware that it is my Christian faith, and it is not everybody's, and people have strongly felt beliefs about other faiths and no faiths, and all of us are citizens.
And I think one of the points that you bring out in the, because I looked at the website as well, and there's, you know, prayer walks and, you know, adopt a street and do some praying, which seems, you know, pretty standard Christian, you know, public activity. Sure. But it's this word "city" that's kind of bothering you, because it is an implication of, you know, government and church, that this is kind of what you're diving into there. The Rapid City mayor is a former pastor, yes, or a current pastor?
You know, I don't know how that works. He was an executive pastor at one of the churches here, and a big, popular, well-attended church. And I don't know if you keep that title when you get another one. But I remember I even wrote a couple of years ago at a community prayer breakfast here that one of the speakers that referred to him, or one of the people that introduced him, as a pastor masquerading as a mayor. Mm-hmm. And everybody laughed about it, and I tried to speak with Mayor Solomon about that a couple of times after that, and we just never managed to get that done. And I think he was a little uncomfortable with it. I think he liked it, and he... You know, but also thought, not everybody's going to like the sound of that. And, you know, and I also had, even beyond the government the question mm-hmm. is just the whole idea that we would own an entire city as Christians when that's, I don't think ownership, and one of the things that struck me too was imagine if you're a Lakota person and you don't happen to be a Christian Lakota person, and you already feel, as an Indian collective sign says, this is our place. And now suddenly we're claiming it for a religion that you don't share and don't participate in. There's just a lot of questions about that. Yeah,
like flag planting, or is it implied that somebody doesn't belong, or that this community doesn't belong to someone else if it belongs to Jesus? There's a lot happening there. It maybe just doesn't all fit on a T-shirt.
Well, yeah, and I think that if you're here, then you're supposed to be Christian. I think I'm concerned about that. You mm-hmm. don't belong to Rapid City if you're not Christian. I was concerned about that point.
So as a Christian, how do you work to make Christ the center of your life but not necessarily the center of your politics? Or alternatively, how does your faith inform your politics?
Well, and I think that's the word. I hope that it informs my politics. I hope that it informs how I conduct my daily life. And I hope good Christian politicians will be informed by what I consider to be the New Testament, especially message of love and forgiveness and charity and grace as the dominant approach to things. Mm-hmm. And, but again, I want when a government leader gets up in the morning and decides how he's going to conduct his business affairs in terms of government and leadership, I referring to the Bible is fine, but I really want him to refer to the Constitution. That's what his job is.
Seth Tupper, what would you add to this as you read Kevin Wooster's commentary, published it in South Dakota Searchlight? What are you looking for, in governmental leaders, who lead with their faith and talk openly about their faith, as in South Dakota is often the case, really?
Well, I would just say how relevant it is as a commentary when you think back, at South Dakota Searchlight, we focus on, state policy, state government, state politics. And, you look back at the last legislative session and we had a bill to require, that would have required, it failed, but would have required the posting of the Ten Commandments in every public school classroom in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Can get a more clear mixing of state and religion than that, and so it's a debate that I think will come back to the legislature. It's something that is going to continue to stay relevant, and it's something that we need voices out there talking about the idea that there should be separation of church and state seems to have fallen out of favor with quite a lot of people, especially on the right side of the political spectrum, and I think it's important to talk about why we have had that tradition in this country and why it's important.
Meanwhile, Seth, there is a lot brewing about hate crimes and hate crime legislation in the next state legislature, which may have completely fizzled out by next January. But as we talk about that, that becomes one of the areas where in the State House you would anticipate religion being discussed on the floor of the House, on the floor of the Senate. What have you seen in some of those debates that you find insightful going forward when we talk about the separation of church and state? Because you've sat in a lot of the State House debate.
I guess what I would say is we definitely have a contingent of legislators that don't believe in the separation of church and state and don't believe that is a foundational idea or principle of our country, and don't believe that it's valid and believe that it should be obliterated. And they're trying to do that with legislation every year, whether it's blatant or whether it's taking a little bite of the apple and trying to get at it a little at a time. Last year, the Ten Commandments bill was a pretty big swing at it that failed. But, in the past, they passed a bill that every school in the state has to have a sign posted that says, "In God We Trust," and that's law. And there are those signs when you walk into the school now.
Yeah.
And so it can be big things or it can be little things. There's a creep that goes on where, maybe this is okay, maybe that's okay, it's not a big deal. And I just think we got to keep the conversation out there and going because, as Kevin says, not everybody is a Christian. It is the predominant religion in South Dakota, but separation of church and state has served our country well to make sure, as Kevin said in the column, that one religion doesn't dominate other people who don't share the same beliefs in the beliefs in the public square. So it's something we have to protect against.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about some candidate announcements, and maybe we'll focus today on the race for the U.S. House. Congressman Dusty Johnson has decided he would like to leave Washington and run for governor of South Dakota, which creates an opening. And we have a couple more people who have now officially said that they are interested in the job. Seth, why don't you kick us off with some of the top Republican announcements that you've seen lately?
Well, yeah, Marty Jackley, the current Republican Attorney General, it was already known that he was going to run, but he held his official kickoff in Sturgis, so I drove up there. I guess that was last week. I don't know. I lose track. It could have been last month or yesterday, the way the news works. But anyway, sometime recently, I drove up there.
September 9th is when you publish the piece.
There you go. The days blend together.
Yeah. But, I got you.
I did drive up there, and he had quite a crowd, quite a bit was made in sort of the political blogosphere about the sort of maybe the ideological diversity of the crowd within the Republican Party. There were legislators there like Scott Odenbach and Phil Jensen, and who you would consider to be maybe more to the far to the right on the political spectrum, and there were more moderate Republicans there, and so not what maybe just a person off the street would call a diverse crowd, but maybe you would call a diverse ideological crowd within the Republican Party. And his announcement, it was interesting to me. He mentioned Trump a couple of times in his speech, but there wasn't, Trump iconography there. It wasn't a huge part of the announcement. He didn't focus on President Trump, which I thought was a different, I don't know if that was on purpose, but it was a different tone than we see out of a lot of other Republican politicians now. And then we saw yesterday, as we're taping this, Casey Crabtree, a state senator from Madison, formally announced, and his announcement seemed to be a lot about President Trump and saying he would be with President Trump on everything. And so a little bit of a different tack there, and maybe that's accidental, and maybe going forward the race will be all about who's more like Trump. I don't know, but at the start, Attorney General Jackley did talk in his announcement about things like, we have to secure the border, and President Trump is doing that, but he also said he wants to work on legal immigration, and he knows the challenges that businesses in the Black Hills have to get enough workers here on temporary visas from other countries to fill tourism jobs in the summer and things like that. So he did sort of broaden his rhetoric a little bit beyond just, hey, I'll be the most supportive of Trump of any candidate in this race.
He has been very vocal about the rule of law, and you're just not going to shake him off the rule of law no matter what. I want to get to some of their vulnerabilities or even liabilities as candidates, Jackley and Crabtree. But Kevin Wooster, some of the things that you see early on in Marty Jackley's campaign, and maybe it's a little early for Casey Crabtree, but things out of the gate that you notice that they're leading with.
Well, I know Marty a lot better than I know Crabtree, so I'm kind of getting a perspective from what Seth wrote. But I was struck by that Crabtree's was so heavily Trump, certainly law and order. He's got a sense, I think, for people out here and the tourism industry and. But I was thinking, Marty, it's almost like your announcement is for the general and not the primary. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that would be, because I assume if he gets by the primary, he's got the general wrapped up. No offense to the Democratic candidate. Are there any?
We'll get there. We'll get there. There are several. There's going to be a Democratic primary, as a matter of fact. So we'll get to that.
Oh, that's right. I read that story.
Yes. All right.
I don't care about that right now. I might start. See, I'm in a position in my journalism career where I don't have to care about stuff like that if I don't feel like it.
I'll care about it later on. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I was struck by that, and the fact that he led on immigration, not with so much with we have to get the, like the Toby Doden type stuff, the stuff that I get in my mailbox where the picture of the horrible looking, we assume he's meant to be or is a gang member, and that represents the immigrants to you, because that doesn't represent the immigrants that we pray for up in my church every day. But that Marty was softer toned on that and more practical on that than I thought he might be. And I thought to myself, will that work in a Republican primary? Hmm. And will he carry through on that message?
There were an awful lot of donors on the list for his kickoff fundraiser in Sioux Falls.
Uh-huh.
Like a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they count in the primary.
They do. Yeah. And are we saying, and do you know enough about the donors, do you, Seth, to think they would like that message better?
So, you know, Casey Crabtree is so early on in the race, I don't think he's had to file a campaign finance report yet, so we don't know. You know, when I've talked to people about the race, though, Senator Crabtree works in economic development, East River. I've been told and I've heard that he apparently has a good fundraising network and is able to tap into a lot of fundraising sources. So I don't, you know, if the assumption is that because Marty Jackley is more name recognition and he's won statewide races before, he'll be able to raise a ton more money. Mm. I've had some people say to me, maybe that's not necessarily as true as you would think. Mm. So that's another reason I was surprised that, I didn't hear Attorney General Jackley go harder to the right as a primary, and maybe he will. You know, maybe this was just among friends and Sturgis and.
Oh, it's oh so early.
Where he grew up.
Yeah.
It's so early.
It's very early. Yes, very.
I think
very
I said early. I said law and order. I think I also meant rule of law. That, you know, that's something that he said again and again. I'm not quite sure what I said there. So some strengths: Marty Jackley, name recognition. Does Casey Crabtree have that name recognition, Seth? Do you think?
No, not at all.
No.
I don't think so. Yeah. You know, obviously, we always distinguish, you know, within Republican circles and primary voters. But, you know, some of his name recognition, frankly, is a problem for him, because among some Republicans, he's known primarily as the guy who prime sponsored a carbon dioxide pipeline bill in 2024 that opponents to the Summit Carbon pipeline, the proposed pipeline, did not like and referred to a vote, and it got rejected by voters.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of those vulnerabilities or liabilities. That's one of his.
Yeah. So to the extent that he has name recognition,
moved out of
leadership.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, which is not necessarily positive for him in a Republican primary.
And I read in your piece, he responded, "I'm never going to apologize for standing up for farmers." That's how. Is that a good way for him to position that particular legislation and his efforts for it? It was a piece by Joshua Heyer in South Dakota Sources.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll find out. I mean, that, you know, I really distinctly remember the day that he and then also Will Mortensen, mm-hmm. they were the two legislators that really came up with that bill in 2024. And their idea that they thought they were doing was they thought they had come up with a great sort of compromise that their bill wasn't going to ban eminent domain for carbon pipelines or stop any carbon pipelines from being built, mm-hmm. but it was going to add new protections for landowners and counties and try to strike this balance of we want development, but we want protection for people affected by development. They thought they had done a great thing. Well, their bill passed. The pipeline opponents hated it. They referred it, got rejected by voters. Then we come to the primary election in 2024. 14 Republican incumbents lose their elections in part because some of them had supported that pipeline bill. Will Mortensen and Casey Crabtree, among others, get booted out of leadership when legislators have their leadership elections. And so it is a little curious. And this is the guy then that's going to run for primary on that record with Republican voters. I think it's going to be a challenge for him. Yeah. I really do.
You probably hit on the Trump thing. He's got to hit Trump hard. He's got to be on
because
Trump
of that.
Because of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other vulnerabilities for Marty Jackley's campaign? Well, where the bumps in the campaign road there?
My question is, I think Marty's good on camera. He's been practicing on camera for years. I mean, he's always accessible. He comes to town. He seeks out reporters. He wants to talk to reporters. He loves to talk to reporters. When's the last time, and I can't think, somebody smarter than I am with a better memory, my brother Terry, maybe would remember when was the last time we sent a lawman to Congress? An attorney general, a South Dakota attorney general, went on to Congress because
Janklow, probably.
Janklow, probably.
Yeah. He had been attorney general.
Anybody before that? I mean, and Janklow always had a little bit of that lawman mentality, but he certainly had, became the governor. Is that a tough leap? I don't know. As I told him in a text, I thought he was very smart not to run for governor, which he, you know, was really interested in doing. And then he talks about getting into D.C. to be in the fight. And let's not use any of that language anymore. Let's not use going to war. Let's not use fighting with the opponents. Let's not, just stop using that as an aside.
Noted.
You know, we're talking about liabilities. You know, mm-hmm. I think my mind and a lot of people's minds for Attorney General Jackley goes to his association with T. Denny Sanford. And
yeah.
He represented T. Denny Sanford when is part of the public record. I want to be careful about what I say here because Sanford was never convicted of anything. But at one point, it's been public record that he was investigated on charges, potential charges related to child pornography. And for a time, when Marty Jackley was in private practice, he represented T. Denny Sanford.
So how does that stick? How does that stick to him? I mean,
well,
T. Denny Sanford isn't
it,
running,
you know.
So his opponent uses it, and he says, "I'm an attorney." And I represent clients in all kinds of difficult scenarios.
Well, that would be if you applied logic to the situation.
Yes, right. That would be reasonable for people.
In politics.
I mean, he just did his job, right? It was to represent somebody vigorously. And that, again, goes back to rule of law. Everybody.
I'm sure
deserves,
that's what he'll say
if
an attack comes. But obviously, I would imagine that there are all manner of creative ways that somebody could come up with to make an emotional political appeal on that might stick with.
Yeah.
With
now
voters.
I see the postcard in my head, and right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
which
it doesn't have to be coming from Crabtree's campaign.
Right.
It probably wouldn't come from Crabtree's campaign. It would come with one of the from one of these fly by night set up for the. Mm-hmm. Specific person of purpose of hurting Jackley late in the campaign. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other weaknesses or things that Crabtree has to overcome, Jackley has to overcome, other than just the general nature of campaigning in America, like physical security is an issue, money and fundraising is an issue. What's happening in Washington is always an issue. But, Kevin, I hear you saying threats from Democrats who are having their own primary is probably not something that's going to keep a Republican candidate up at night.
Well, I wouldn't think it would unless the Republican candidate is hyper, concerned about those kind of things. It's a little bit overly paranoid. All I hope is that the candidate that does run is a credible candidate who puts up important issues because that matters, and it always matters. I have a little sport with the Democrats on that, and I'm sure they don't always appreciate it, but it is important that the Republican candidate has a challenger and has a credible, reasonable challenger who raises real issues in a real way and has enough money, hopefully not his or her own money, but that raised for them to raise those issues. And so I do hope that happens.
And who is out there, Seth, listening to, people around the kitchen table, in the local coffee shop, finding out what South Dakota's issues are. That's also the role of a Democratic candidate, is to go out and listen and find out where are the gaps, what do people need, what would make a successful campaign for them. That's everybody's job, but it's especially important for Democrats who don't have much of a foothold, if any at all, politically in the state.
Yeah, and to bring their names into it, Billy Mahoney is a nonprofit executive in Sioux Falls who said he's going to run.
Mm-hmm.
Nikki Gronley, formerly was the director of rural development in South Dakota for the USDA, she said she's going to run.
Mm-hmm.
There's another guy named Scott Schlegel, I don't know much about, but has filed a statement of candidacy with the FEC. So it looks like if they all stay in it, there will be a primary, and certainly will be people that seem to be credible candidates who will be in there mixing it up. So I think, by and large, the fact that we'll have a lively Republican primary and a lively Democratic primary for House, that's something we don't get a lot in South Dakota, is have lively primaries on both sides. So there should be a great back and forth and debate, and I think it'll be good for the process and good for voters.
That's this week's Dakota Political Junkies conversation. Our guests there, journalist Kevin Wooster and Seth Tupper. You can find this conversation and more political coverage online. Search SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to read that piece from Kevin or any of Seth Tupper's works, head to SouthDakotaSearchlight.com. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new weekly NPR podcast brings listeners the latest national security news. Sources and Methods is hosted by NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. I spoke with her about how the show got started and who some of her sources are.
Sources and Methods, as I gather you might know, is a often used, well-known term in intelligence and national security circles. It gets to the, how do we know what we know? Who told us? By what means did we gather this information? And, you know, you will hear American presidents and other leaders at the top of the national security apparatus talking about the paramount importance of protecting sources and methods. You don't want, if you are U.S. intelligence, you don't want your adversary to know how they know what they know, because then it might allow them to shut down that method, whether it's a satellite intercept or a human source well-placed in the inner circles of the corridors of power in some foreign capital overseas. So it also has a double meaning because, of course, reporters work sources. We are not spies here, for the record. We're journalists trying to do our job. But, you know, as you know, we also work sources in the service of digging into stories and trying to present our audience with the most full and complete picture of what's happening in their communities and country and around the world. So it felt like a nice nod to both the kind of work that reporters are doing, and which we sometimes have to protect our sources and methods too, if a source is putting themselves at risk in sharing with us what they know. And it also gets to the subject matter, which of course is national security, foreign policy.
Yeah. And by putting yourself at risk in America and in the current environment in Washington, President Donald Trump has cleaned house with a lot of people that he feels have not done the job according to his standards. What does protecting a source mean in this day and age for you as a journalist and for the NPR international correspondents that you feature on the show?
Well, what you say is true, in that we have seen all kinds of firings and purges since President Trump returned to the White House for the second term. They have hit particularly hard in the intelligence community, where in these first 9 months of 2025, the head of the National Security Agency has been forced out. The head of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency at the Pentagon, has been forced out. 37 people and counting have lost security clearances. The president's own former national security advisor from his first term, John Bolton, has been targeted and had his home and office here in Greater Washington searched. I could go on. So there's a lot happening. The climate is tense. That makes it all the more important, I think, to try to separate fact from fiction and conspiracy theory from what we actually know. So, you know, the reporting hasn't changed. We're still out there just trying to gather facts and then share them with our audience. And that feels more important than ever, to get away from all of the analysis and editorializing and just say, these are reporters, they're well-sourced, they've been working these beats in many cases for years. Let them share with us. Here's what I know. Here's how I know it. This is where I went today. This is what people told me firsthand. This is what I saw with my own eyes. This is what I heard with my own ears. Let me put these facts out there to hopefully advance our knowledge of what is happening in our country and in the world. And then let everybody listening make up their minds, their own minds, what they want to think about it.
Yeah. There are so many international events right now and national security concerns. How do you choose each week the ones that you're going to bring to the show?
It's so tough. Yeah. There is so much happening. I was conferring with one of my editors yesterday, and she said, does it feel like the news gods have dreamt up this absolute fire hose of national security news to coincide with sources and methods launching so we'd have plenty to talk about? And I thought, A, yes, and B, the fire hose never stops. I mean, it's just nonstop. So we are constantly trying to figure out. For example, this week, there's big breaking news out of the Middle East with Israel having launched airstrikes on Hamas targets inside Doha. There is big international breaking news out of Poland, where for the first time we have Poland, a NATO member and U.S. ally, engaged with Russian planes in Polish airspace. What happens there? Meanwhile, we have it's the anniversary of September 11th.
Yeah.
And that feels worth going back and remembering and walking through, because all of the changes that came to U.S. national security and intelligence after 9/11 with the purpose of let's never have that happen again. Let's do everything we can to reorganize the way we protect this country so that nothing like 9/11 can happen on U.S. soil again. Some of those changes are being done. Some of those changes are being questioned. Let's look at what could be lost, what could be gained. Why does this matter?
Yeah. I myself was genuinely shocked and surprised to read in the New York Times about a SEAL Team 6 attack in North Korea.
Yeah.
Where do you begin with things that are happening like that as far as you're calling your, you know, correspondents in Asia to say, what did you hear? What do you know?
That's exactly what we're doing now. Yeah. We, like every other Western news organization, are not able to cover North Korea in quite the way that we would like.
Right.
I have reported from there, but it is very rare and very difficult to get visas. And even if we could, we probably wouldn't be there at the exact moment that a Navy SEAL team is rolling in. So, you know, we're working that from the Pentagon.
Yeah.
We are working that through the intel committees on Capitol Hill. We are working that through Greg Myrie, my colleague on the National Security Beat, who covers the CIA and the National Security Agency, and trying to find out what his sources are telling him that may track or may not with what Tom Bowman's sources at the Pentagon are telling him. But
yeah.
Then, yes, getting it out into, let's go to Asia. Let's get, we don't have someone in Pyongyang, but we do have Anthony Kuhn, who's based full-time in Seoul. And that's so important because the fact that he's based there, that NPR keeps a bureau there so that, yes, when North or South Korea are in the headlines, we have someone there. But we also have someone there on the days when it seems quiet in the news there, when there are things happening that you didn't know about. He's got his whole Rolodex people he can call and ask, what are you hearing? What are you seeing? How does this square or not? What is the messaging here? How can you help me confirm what we're hearing out of the Pentagon? So that's the kind of thing we're kicking around on the podcast every week is open your reporter's notebook. Tell me what questions are on your mind. Tell me the little crumbs of information that maybe didn't seem huge in any given moment, but which add up. And when combined with the crumbs somebody else is gathering in their reporter's notebook, start to become a story you can follow.
Already, I've listened to all the episodes that I have access to, and it is smart and interesting, and I'm obsessed with it already. Also, at the very end, you have this delightful open source intelligence segment where people chime in with something that you can find pretty much anywhere, but it's still OSINT. Tell us about that.
Exactly. Well, you've just summarized it. OSINT.
But tell me more.
Intelligence. Yeah. So it's out there. It's public. Anybody could look for it, but you might not have been looking for it. It's an attempt to do water cooler chit chat, but from the national security world. And so I'm encouraging my colleagues, bring me something you don't have the full story on. You don't have all sides of this. It's just a little nugget that piqued your curiosity, or it's someone you noticed who is playing a pivotal role. I remember in one of our early pilots, I was flagging Steve Witkoff, who is now the American official charged with everything, as far as I can see. He's in charge of the talks to try to bring peace to Ukraine. He's in charge of U.S. engagement, peace talks in the Middle East. This is a man who had not had diplomatic experience until this year. He's a commercial New York commercial real estate guy. So, but he has the trust of President Trump. So that I started seeing his name, and then I started seeing, wait, is that the same Witkoff who's also running things in the Middle East? And let me put him on your radar because you're going to be hearing about this guy. That was a few months ago, and here we are. We're hearing a lot about this guy. So it's just it's an attempt to flag. Here's something to keep your eye on. Here's just a little morsel of NatSec gossip that might be worth having in your head as you're trying to make sense of headlines.
The first few episodes of NPR's new podcast, Sources and Methods, are out now. Find them wherever you get your podcasts. My guest today was NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, host of Sources and Methods. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by R. Youngman and Ellen Kester. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.